He had to quickly evacuate overnight. Mayor William Ash of West Point, Kentucky, says it was the only thing to do since the chemicals were burning and there was the chance of an explosion. Lisa Johnson was among the evacuees, and she was chilly when a reporter spoke with her.
We had three grandkids with me, so when I packed their stuff up, forgot my jacket. So I had no clothes.
Officials say the fire started when workers were trying to separate several derailed cars, apparently using a torch or welder. A platinum company at the center of a miners' revolt and strike in South Africa says it is considering restructuring its operations. Lonmin Platinum says the labor unrest, which included the deaths of 40 people, most at the hands of police, has reduced output and increased costs. Beyond that, Lonmin says it is offering few details of its plans. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org.
WILL programming is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study. The MillerCom 2013 lecture, Scientists' Responsibility to Society, originally scheduled for this Thursday, has been canceled due to the weather. It will be rescheduled. More information is available at the Center for Advanced Study website.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We had intended a different program today featuring a guest who was to give a lecture on campus this week. However, Superstorm Sandy arrived. The guest could not join us in person. We then hoped to have him join us by phone. That turned out not to be an option today either. Ultimately, we had to cancel the program. Such is the world of radio talk shows. So today, instead, we will listen back to a program from early September with journalist Fran Hawthorne discussing social consumerism. As this is pre-recorded, please disregard any requests for calls today, though we do encourage you to post comments on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Enjoy the show. Good morning, and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. There are lots of reasons to purchase products from one company over another. Usually, we consider price or quality or convenience, but sometimes the decision is a moral one. Does the company treat its workers well? Does it do business with unsavory people? Does it use sound environmental practices? In other words, do we deem the company in question to be socially responsible, however you may define that term? So, if you're the type of person that wants to buy products made in the USA or made from recycled materials or whatever, you seek out those companies that have that socially responsible reputation. But how do you really know that reputation's deserved? Journalist Fran Hawthorne has contemplated that question and set out to uncover whether some of the most beloved, trusted companies who have built up a socially responsible reputation really live up to their hype. In her book, Ethical Chic, The Inside Story of the Companies We Think We Love, Hawthorne takes us behind the scenes of six companies with surprisingly powerful brand loyalty: Toms of Maine, Timberland, Starbucks, Apple, Trader Joe's, and American Apparel. Along the way, she finds out why these companies have earned seemingly unflagging devotion from socially conscious consumers, and she calls out the companies and consumers alike with a provocative question: is it really about being socially conscious or just looking like you are? As we begin our conversation, we want to know what companies you deem to be socially responsible, that you have concluded operate in an ethical way, and tell us what's led you to that conclusion. Or, if you don't really take that into consideration, tell us what factors do motivate you to select one company over another, one product over another. Are you influenced by a socially responsible image? Fran, how do we know if a given company is socially responsible?
Yeah, the one thing you can't judge it by is its ads, its marketing, its image, because it has in fact become such a great selling point to be seen as, you know, nice to animals or environmental. So there are many, many ways you can do this. Part of it is indeed a different kind of word of mouth, you know, from what friends that you know care about these issues, what they say if they've been using the product for years, or what certain trusted organizations say. There are a number of lists that you might want to consult, such as the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has a list of companies that do not test on animals. Greenpeace rates companies on their environmental abilities and actions. So there are a certain few well-known lists that you can consult. You can as well read the labels. I'm not talking, of course, about the marketing labels, but rather the ingredient labels. Look for the little bunny. I don't even think it looks like a bunny, but the little symbol that shows whether something has been tested on animals. So those are some ways you can start.
So I mentioned those six companies that you investigated. How did you decide on those six?
Oh, it was a long, convoluted process, which I'll try to shorten here. I started out, just because I've been writing about these issues for years, I had certain companies I had been gathering information on, knew their reputations, and then I reached out to a number of people I've interviewed over the years to ask them, who would you nominate? I talked to activists, consumer rights advocates, environmental activists, people like labor unions, people who are anti-sweatshop activists, animal rights groups, diversity groups, all kinds of people. And then I had certain criteria as well. I wasn't going to take the six that got the most stars. You know, I wanted some variety. I only wanted one per industry, since I had set my own limit of six, knowing that that was sort of all I could handle in a reasonable amount of time. So I wanted big companies that were well-known. I wanted a variety of industries. I wanted companies that were based in the U.S. so that I could more easily research them. So it was a combination of kind of gut, you know, reaction and research on various different areas.
So taking all of those criteria into account, how does what you refer to as hipness, you know, or I guess the chic part of ethical chic in the title of your book, how does that play into this conversation?
That was even harder in a way to gauge. You know it when you see it. For instance, one company I considered was Costco because it has many wonderful aspects to it, but Costco doesn't have that edge of being chic and hip the way Trader Joe's does. You just know it, right? You, Craig, you know this yourself in your gut, right?
Well, I guess yes and no. I guess the question is, who determines that, and who says, well, this company, you know, has a particular image or reputation with a particular subset of the consumer audience, and so they sort of fit this criteria.
It is a balancing act. You know, and to some degree, it's circular, I guess, right? Companies get a reputation because they have a reputation, because they are known by people who consider themselves cool, then they become known as cool. And maybe it's unfair as well, but you just, it's all balancing of so many different aspects, some of which is image. I mean, that was the other thing. I had to start with companies that have an image of being both cool and social responsible to see whether they deserve the social responsibility part of it. If a company was not even seen as being socially responsible, then that's a different book. But that wasn't the book I was starting out to write.
But do consumers tend to mix up those two concepts?
Definitely. And Apple is the absolute example of that.
Well, I want to get into that in just a couple of minutes. In fact, we'll talk about all six of those companies. But a reminder, you're listening to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is Fran Hawthorne, author of the book Ethical Chic, The Inside Story of the Companies We Think We Love. We're discussing what's commonly known as corporate social responsibility, the effort among some corporations to demonstrate ethical business practices and consumers who are drawn to those companies. We'd like to know if there are companies or products you deem to be in some way more ethical than others and whether that influences the goods and services you purchase. We welcome other questions and comments as well. To join us on air, you can call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. And actually, before we get into each of those companies that you sort of laid out in the book, I want to take a call. We have a caller on the line from Belgium. Good morning.
Good morning. The question I'm going to ask you, guest, is that, you know, you talk about ethical dealings with people and different things like that, and probably one that we think is probably as ethical as it can be is a farmer's market. Now, how would you compare a farmer's market with somebody like Apple in the fact that how they would be ethical? If you're saying, I know they're both one totally not related as far as economic situations, but there is the actual aspect of selling your products and how you deal with your products and how the, quote, farmer at the farmer's market, though it's not always a farmer, deals with his customer in an ethical way and how that relates to the way that the ethical decisions are being made at Apple or Costco or Trader Joe's. Trader Joe's and farmer's market would have a lot of similarities in ways.
All right. Thanks very much for the question. It's an interesting comparison. How can you line up the sorts of things that you investigated about these companies with something like a farmer's market.
You're right. I love farmer's markets. They're wonderful. They encompass so many values that we see as ethical, starting with the fact, of course, that they're local. I mean, there's got to be, just practically speaking, a geographical limit after which it doesn't make sense for the farmer to bring the goods in. So therefore, they are also good for the environment because they're using less gas, you know, to bring the products in. Depending on the organization that oversees the farmer's market, there may be various rules about being organic or not, using pesticides or not. But as a general rule, they do use fewer pesticides, fewer chemicals, so the food is healthier for both the earth and your body. It hasn't been, you know, processed and packaged to go long distances. Yet usually you meet, if not the farmer, someone who works on the farm or a relative. Again, each organization is different. I know here in New York, where I am, the local organization that oversees farmers markets requires that somebody connected with the farm must be sitting there at the stand so that you can talk to the person and find out how it was grown. And again, there's this whole personal aspect that is so missing from the big corporates. So there's so many, many good things about farmers markets. Practically speaking, though, they're very limited. You can only get the produce that is grown locally in that season. And, of course, it's pretty limited to produce. There might be some home crafts. So, obviously, you can't get computers at a farmer's market. So you can't, you know, apply that to every kind of thing you'd want to buy. But it's so interesting that you compare it to Trader Joe's because these two are polar opposites. This is one of the things that I found out that may surprise people about Trader Joe's because it has this funky neighborhood organic local image, and it is absolutely not. It's a big chain of over 350 stores in the United States, and as you may know, being in Belgium, it's actually owned by a German conglomerate, and furthermore, Trader Joe's whole, you know, raison d'etre, as it were, is to bring food from all over the world, pre-cook it, sell it all packaged and wrapped up, you know, here in the supermarket. So it is completely the opposite of local, although obviously it does have some locally grown organic produce. So it depends on what your values are, of course, whether you're going to go to a Trader Joe's or a farmer's market, or whether you're lucky enough even to have a farmer's market in your neighborhood.
So we've talked about Trader Joe's. Let's talk a little bit about the other companies you looked into. First of all, Tom's of Maine has this reputation for being a family-owned business. They produce environmentally friendly toothpaste, manufactured to sort of this perception we have is on a commune somewhere in the woods of Maine. There's a mint garden in the back. How much of that is true?
Well, there is a garden, although it's really for show. They don't use the herbs that are grown in the garden in the toothpaste. It's not a commune. It's a company, a profit-making company. It was family-founded. Let me correct that. It was founded by Tom Chappell. He and his wife ran it for years. At different times, one or another of their five children worked there. None of that is true anymore, however. Ultimately, what happened is that Tom and Kate got tired. They were getting older. They, understandably, wanted to stop doing that. None of their kids was either interested or really old enough to take over. So the couple sold the company to Colgate, a big conglomerate toothpaste company that uses chemicals. Now, the Tom's of Maine toothpaste still uses natural ingredients itself. So there are real aspects that are true about the myth and some things that are not true.
And I guess that's sort of the case with all of these companies, that there are some things, some reputations they've built up that are deserved and then some maybe not so much.
Right, exactly. And that's what I tried to find out in doing my research.
I have to share one thing about Tom's of Maine, and it's you describe one devoted customer who uses Tom's of Maine toothpaste, noting how different it is, how much better for the environment, and what a better product it is than the toothpaste she grew up with, which in fact was Colgate. And so the fact that Colgate now owns it, I get the impression that's something that maybe she and a lot of other consumers just don't know.
Exactly. There were people who were surprised when I told them. And some people then said, well, I'm not going to buy Tom's anymore because it's part of a big conglomerate, which may be one of the values that's important to you. Or you may say, well, you know what? the Tom's toothpaste itself is still natural and better than most of the others out there, so I will keep buying it. So those are among the issues that you as a consumer have to juggle.
Why did you decide to investigate Starbucks? What interested you about that company?
Again, Starbucks is one of these classic companies, like Trader Joe's, like Apple, that has this reputation for being somehow more ethical than the others of its ilk. It's supposedly, in the public image, it uses fair trade coffee, and it's nice to its workers. And doesn't every barista know everybody by name who walks in or something like that? It's like the commune with Tom's. It somehow got this reputation. And so I did indeed. It was a perfect example of being seen as both hip and ethical. And so when I investigated it, probably, you won't be surprised to hear that some of these myths are true and some are not.
And can you elaborate on that?
Sure.
Which ones are true, which ones are not?
It is true that Starbucks provides health care coverage to virtually all its workers, even part-timers, which is amazing. Most companies in the fast food industry, which Starbucks is in, though it hates to admit it, don't have any coverage like that at all. In fact, most in the restaurant industry don't, and too many companies in this country at all don't. So that is truly part of the DNA. It was very important to the founder of Starbucks. On the other hand, the baristas actually don't know anybody. I mean, I sat and listened to over 400 interactions of a barista taking an order from a customer from literally across the country from Massachusetts to California. And almost never did a barista actually seem to know somebody. Most of the time they talk to each other, the customers are on their phones. There isn't this personal touch. That's a complete myth. The idea of fair trade coffee, there is some. It's not all. It's increasing. My biggest problem with Starbucks, I have a few big problems, but one of them is the waste, the complete waste of paper, 32,000 tons per year. Unnecessary. You know, you walk into McDonald's or Wendy's, and the first thing they will say to you is this to stay or to go? You walk into Starbucks, and they shove a paper cup in your face. And all they have to do is learn to say, is this to stay or to go? And if it's to stay, they can hand you a mug that can be washed and reused and save literally tons of paper a year. I don't know why they don't do it. I have talked to them about this. It's one of the simplest steps in the world that could have such an impact.
Well, I imagine some of that has to do with speed, that they can deliver the coffee or whatever it may be a little bit faster if they're just using the same paper cups each time. And one of the things that you point out in the book is that sometimes these questions of social responsibility are at odds with each other. And this might be one such example where maybe it's not as environmentally friendly, but from a customer service standpoint, maybe they win points by delivering that drink a little bit faster.
Actually, the reason they gave me was storage space. That they don't have enough space to store all these mugs in some of the stores, especially the smaller ones, which I think you could make room if you wanted to. Now, speed is an interesting question, and I have mulled that one over. It would probably slow things down slightly. But if people are going to Starbucks because they think it's a socially responsible company, I'm not sure how much they would be troubled by 30-second delay if they knew that it was being good for the environment, especially since the customers are all on their phones and talking to each other anyway. I don't know how much they're even noticing the delay.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're taking your questions about how social responsibility impacts what we buy and the companies we buy from. My guest is journalist Fran Hawthorne, author of the book Ethical Chic, The Inside Story of the Companies We Think We Love. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome questions and comments via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages or on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. The phone number again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. So one of the more intriguing companies you decided to investigate is Apple. Is there any company on earth that seems to have developed a stronger allegiance from its customers?
You know, probably not. It is amazing, isn't it, that people are just so devoted. I mean, I went when the iPad came out, and I went to the flagship store in Manhattan to see the people camped out, you know, for sometimes two nights in advance to get make sure they got it. Even people who had pre-ordered and were guaranteed one no matter when they walked in were still camped out to get maybe the accessories or to be part of the experience. I mean, it's amazing. Can you think of another company where people would camp out at night or two nights in advance to get a product?
I think it'd have to be a Harry Potter book or something like
right.
that.
That's true. That's true.
You do note that some customers sort of assume that Apple is a, for lack of a better term, a green company, one that employs environmentally friendly practices by and large. Why does that perception exist, and is it, in your view, deserved?
Isn't that amazing? No, in my view, it's not deserved, and I'll get to that in a minute. But why it persists, partly it's what you were talking about earlier. People love this company, and they want to think only good things about it. And the customers tend to be young, hip, cutting edge, the kind of people who do care about the environment. And so they just assume, well, they would never love a company that wasn't good for the environment. It's this kind of circular reasoning. As well, things like Al Gore being on the board of Apple, people again assume, well, Al Gore, you know, the writer of Inconvenient Truth, clearly he would never be on the board of a company that wasn't environmental. So it just creates this false image. And for years, Apple just coasted along, ignoring all these issues. It would constantly rate at the bottom of all those rankings. I mentioned earlier things like Greenpeace ranking companies. Apple was always at the bottom. Another ranking is Climate Counts, which looks at carbon emissions. Apple was at the bottom over and over again. It didn't join the industry groups that were trying to improve, you know, their recycling or other environmental issues. Finally, I mean, to its credit, about 5 years ago, Apple started sort of feeling the pressure, paying attention, and, you know, image is very important to Apple. So Apple finally decided this was something it needed to change, and it has improved.
Apple is a notoriously insulated company. They don't like showing people how they operate behind the scenes. Is that an important factor when considering how they demonstrate corporate social responsibility?
Yes. In fact, you could argue it's the most important factor because, of course, how can you know what a company is really doing unless it's somewhat transparent, it somewhat talks about what it's doing. And Apple's secrecy is part, I suppose, why it was able to continue with the phony green image for so long. Nobody really knew what was going on.
We have a couple other companies to talk about. I want to get to those, but I wanted to ask you first. I could imagine someone listening to this asking themselves, so what? What do I care what a company thinks in terms of being socially responsible? If they put out a good product, if the product costs something appropriate, if it's convenient for me, you know, maybe I just don't take any of this into account. Why should I care?
Indeed, many people do feel that way, and I would certainly never, ever denigrate the importance of price, especially in this economy. So we absolutely have to consider things like price and reliability. You know, it's cheap, but it's going to keep breaking and the cost of repairs. So there are so many factors you have to consider. And you, each person, you have to make your own choice as to what's important. But I would give several reasons for caring about these other ethical issues. For one thing, nothing is in a vacuum. Price also has to do with the price we pay living on this planet. You know, as companies keep wasting resources unnecessarily, you know, using electricity rather than finding, you know, efficient ways to save it, this is going to have a cost for us just living on the planet, and ultimately, frankly, it's going to raise the company's prices too, because you just can't go on wasting the Earth's resources. So there is actually a selfish reason to care about how a company is concerned about the environment, for instance.
Well, if you do take that position, though, isn't there a point at which you say, well, the more I dig, the more I'm going to find something about just about any company out there that's in the business, let's face it, of making money, that I'm going to find doesn't jibe with my own personal ethics?
Sure. There is no perfect company. You know, even the ones that would seem to be the highest, best, you know, Tom's of Maine or Timberland, have their faults. And if you wanted to find only a perfect company that behaved just like you, you would have to kind of sit home and make everything yourself. So that's why it keeps coming back to this, what I talked about before, juggling and balancing your values. And you do the best you can, and the companies, we hope, do the best they can. Some of them do the best they can.
The other two companies that you include in your book and in your research are Timberland and American Apparel. Tell us a little bit about each one of those and what intrigued you about those operations.
Sure. I mean, American Apparel was, no doubt about it, the most controversial one in the book. When I would list the companies I was doing, some people were absolutely appalled that I included American Apparel, and their answer very simply was, it's soft porn. Those ads are just seen as pornographic, way too sexually suggestive. And as well, the founder has been sued something like 9 times for sexual harassment in ways that you just don't find at most other companies. And so those are indeed some real faults about American Apparel. The reason I included it, it may well be unique. I hate the word unique, because you find one other example, something is no longer unique. But I think in this case it's true of American Apparel. It is the largest manufacturer that still makes clothing in the United States, and it makes fashionable clothing, and it makes them in good working conditions, and it treats its workers decently. And I have been there. I've been to the factory. I've talked to some organizers, and this is something we need to encourage, I think, to get more manufacturing back in the U.S. and certainly to get companies to treat their workers well. So this is, again, an incredible balancing act. And not only that, I should add that American Apparel also is a strong advocate of immigrants' rights. And, again, I think we need much more consciousness about this in this country. So you balance that against the ads, against the lawsuits. It's not one of the best companies in my book because those lawsuits are very troubling. The sexual atmosphere there is very troubling, but it is certainly worth looking at and discussing.
We have an email question from Itza who asks, does the societal image of these companies filter into the corporate culture? In other words, do employees of these companies that are perceived as ethical and green in particular tend to operate in a more ethical and green fashion? Is there less turnover in these companies with better images as opposed to other stores and brands of similar industries, Apple versus Dell, Trader Joe's versus County Market or some other chain, et cetera?
There is less turnover when the image is real. Okay, Starbucks and Trader Joe's do have relatively low turnover compared, for example, to Walmart, which has high turnover. So, yes, because treating your workers well will encourage them to stay, which is another reason why companies should treat their workers well, not out of altruism, but to save themselves money, because it costs a lot to constantly train new workers. So do the workers like working there better? It, to some degree, of course, depends on the individual and on the company. The Trader Joe's workers, they really seem to buy into that. I've talked to some of them, and they seem to enjoy it and to get into the kind of whole let's have fun and joke with the customers mood. The Starbucks baristas, not nearly as much. It's just kind of a job. Now, some of them love the coffee, and it's different, but it depends on which person, obviously. So, but I think if the image is real, clearly Toms of Maine is the kind of place where the image is real, and it gives the workers paid time off to volunteer in the community. So that's going to create a tremendous sense of company loyalty and spirit.
The only company we haven't talked about yet is Timberland. Why did you include Timberland in your book?
Timberland is like Tom's. It's really seen by activists of all sorts as the real epitome of an ethical company, and deservedly so. It does so many things right. It also gives its workers paid time off for community service. It usually makes these lists of best companies to work for. It provides, on-site child care, and it works very hard in terms of being environmental to constantly find alternative energy to power its, offices, to find ways to reduce waste. So in so many ways, it is a good company. Its biggest problem is its basic product. It makes things out of leather, and leather inherently has some serious environmental problems. It's the tanning process, by the way, that causes the problems. It's not raising cows or killing cows, because cows are raised for meat. The leather is just a byproduct. But the problem is the tanning, which uses very polluting chemicals. And Timberland is trying very hard to find the least polluting ways it can, you know, do the tanning.
It sounds like that might be one example of a company that where its corporate culture is in line with the societal image.
Very much so. Again, it's not perfect, but it is one that really does live up to its image.
We are due to take a short break, and then we will continue with this conversation and some more of your phone calls. This is Focus.
Illinois Public Media, along with the League of Women Voters of Illinois and WCIA-TV3, WCIX-TV49, presents the 13th Congressional District Debate. The candidates are Republican Rodney Davis, Democrat David Gill, and Independent John Hartman. I'm Jim Meadows. I'll be your moderator. The 13th Congressional District Debate, tonight at 7 on WILL-TV, AM 580, and WCIX-TV.
Support for today's broadcast comes from the 4th Annual Champaign Urbana Folk and Roots Festival, November 2nd and 3rd in downtown Urbana, with over 70 artists performing blues, jazz, old-time, Cajun, bluegrass, and Irish music. The festival also features storytelling, Saturday workshops, and family activities. Schedules and information at cufolkandroots.org.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. We're discussing what's commonly known as corporate social responsibility, the effort among some corporations to demonstrate ethical business practices and consumers who are drawn to those companies. My guest is Fran Hawthorne, author of Ethical Chic, the inside story of the companies we think we love. In it, Hawthorne takes us behind the scenes of six companies with surprisingly powerful brand loyalty: Toms of Maine, Timberland, Starbucks, Apple, Trader Joe's, and American Apparel. Along the way, she finds out why these companies have earned seemingly unflagging devotion from socially conscious consumers. We'll go next to Russ in Urbana. Good morning, Russ.
Good morning, yes. I would also like to suggest that people take this approach when they choose investments, because, you know, often people won't shop at certain stores, but they might be investing in, or whoever they have investing on their behalf might be certainly investing in these companies. And in another note, do you have any good, like, online resources for people to look up companies? Because it seems like for most people, it's kind of hard to find a place you can, you know, get an idea just, you know, how a company rates, especially if you want to compare them to other companies, so you can get, you know, pick the best of a bad lot, so to speak. I know the two lists you mentioned, but is there anything beyond that you know of?
All right, Russ, thanks very much for the question. Some good resources, perhaps, Fran?
Hi, Russ. Yeah, thanks for the question. Well, first, I want to get to your first point about investing, which is an important point. And there's a whole movement that's been around for at least since the 1970s that used to be called socially responsible investing, and it's now sort of changed to ESG, environmental social governance. But there are definitely a number of mutual funds out there that exactly try to use these kinds of principles for their investing. So that is a good point, and it is, again, something that people can do in their lives. And that, indeed, those funds are listed in a list. And, Russ, you'd think I'd planted you to plant this question, but I didn't. I did put together a list online of a list of lists of places to go that rate according to environment, according to treatment of workers, according to sweatshops overseas, all these kinds of issues. And I guess the simplest way to tell people verbally right now is to say, if you go to the publisher's website, which is Beacon, B-E-A-C-O-N, beacon.org, and you type in my name or the name of the book, Ethical Chic, that will lead you to the resource list. That's probably the simplest way, and I'm sorry to kind of make you do a couple of steps.
Well, actually, you know what? Let me shorten those steps. What we'll do after the show, we'll post a link on our website directly to those lists. Oh. So that'll be at will.illinois.edu/focus. Just find today's program post, and we'll have a link right there for you.
Thanks, Craig. That's great.
And then he was making the point about investments, and you noted that that's, you know, another way that people can approach being socially responsible in terms of the businesses that they support. Again, though, there is complication there that when it comes to things like 401ks and mutual funds, we don't always know precisely. I mean, you know, you might get a prospectus in the mail, but you don't always know from day to day where your money is going and how it's being traded.
Yeah, and especially with 401ks, it's very hard to do the socially responsible investing because there's just beginning to be a trend of some companies starting to offer this as an option. Very, very tiny. So it's probably something you're going to have to do on your own. Now, the mutual fund companies can give you a list of where they invest, but that's going to change to some degree day to day. The best thing you can get is a list of their criteria, what they will never invest in, what they will consider. I mean, for example, most of them will never invest in a tobacco company. Will they invest in a company that does nuclear power? They might, if it's only a small percentage of a company has a lot of wind and solar. You know, so each of these mutual fund companies' criteria are different. But those are the kinds of things you certainly can get.
Everyone has their own particular code of ethics, and there are some things certainly most of us agree on, but we do have our own ideological perceptions about the world, our own motivations for why to support one cause over another, and then that can sort of translate into whether to shop at one store or buy one product over another, as we've been talking about. But then there are cases where you get into political ideology. Take the summer when the president of Chick-fil-A expressed his views opposing same-sex marriage and in so doing sort of placed his fast food chain in the center of a national policy debate. Those who agreed with him mounted a campaign to frequent Chick-fil-A restaurants, and then those who opposed his views mounted a campaign to boycott the restaurants. What would motivate the head of a company to potentially alienate half of its customer base by making public statements like that?
Well, that's an unusual case, the one you mentioned, where apparently he was really driven by his religious beliefs. Now, that's not a company I investigated for my book, so I can only talk about what I have heard and read in the public sphere. But it does seem to be a case of just him going with his religious beliefs and saying, probably saying in places where the chain is usually located, there probably would be more people supporting his view, or there'll be enough people who don't care. He probably also calculated, you know, knows his customer base and calculated the possible losses. You know, there are people like the brand loyalty, like with Apple. There's this kind of brand loyalty to these chains, and they'll keep eating there anyway. So it's again, a juggling act, but I'm thinking it was a combination of both those things.
Is it possible to only buy products from companies whose policies and views comport with your own in this world today? Can we actually do that?
Starting with the caveat that no company is perfect, so you're going to have to do some compromises and say this company does things I disagree with, but let's say the majority of things the company does I agree with, you're going to have to start with that. If you start with that, yes, I do think it's possible. But you may have to have a kind of limited life. You may have to give up certain things that you might otherwise want to do or spend more than you would. But I do think that if you do the research and do that kind of juggling I mentioned, you know, accepting that no company is perfect, then I think you can.
You, at the end of your book, sort of kind of add up a raw score and try and evaluate where these companies, you know, that are sort of a snapshot, where they fit in terms of environmental awareness and impact and, how they treat their workers and a variety of other factors. How do you decide which ethical factors matter more than others?
Well, you have to decide that, each person. Have to decide that. I know what matters to me, and I would never want to lecture somebody to say, you should make this the most important. What I can do, and have tried to do in the book and in that resource list, is say, here are the facts. This is what this company does. This is the image. This is what's true. This is what's not. These are the kind of ratings this company gets from organizations that rate on these principles. Okay, now you decide whether, like, take the example of American Apparel that I brought up earlier. You have to decide whether, for you, the fact that it's such a strong advocate for immigrants' rights and treats its workers well in the sense of, you know, pay and working conditions and is manufacturing here, if those are more important to you than the sexual harassment and the oversex ads. So I can't tell you that, but I can just tell you here the facts.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. My guest is Fran Hawthorne, author of Ethical Chic. The book explores corporate social responsibility and whether companies that have a reputation for it deserve to be put on a pedestal. We welcome your questions and comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You note in your book how for some companies and some consumers, it's not so much important that they are socially responsible, just that they look like they are. This is something we hadn't really talked about yet. No matter the truth of the matter, Tom's of Maine looks environmentally friendly. So by extension, someone who has that tube of toothpaste in their bathroom looks like they care about the environment. Is that part of the motivation for some people, that it's not so much a desire to be ethical in the products that they purchase as much as, and I'm talking about consumers as well as companies here, projecting that image to others?
Yeah, that's a good point, especially as you point out, referring it to consumers. The good side of the point you raise is that it is increasingly important for companies. They see that there is a huge and growing market of people who care about these issues, or who care about having the image that they care about these issues. And therefore, companies want to be seen this way. And because, especially with the internet, it is so easy to be caught out in a lie, companies are going to have to start actually living up to their image. So that's the good part of it. It is definitely of growing importance to companies. Now, it's such an interesting point you raise about the consumers. Again, it depending on kind of your neighborhood, you know, your culture where you hang out, but it is often important to be seen as being cool. I mean, there are things that if you want to be, popular or date the right kind of people or not be shunned or whatever, you would never walk into, you would never walk in right with a bag from Walmart, let's say, among certain circles, right? This would just be horrible, be seen as horrible. One of the people I interviewed was saying that she was taking her daughter to get sneakers, and it was the day before school, and she desperately needed, and she was going to get Nikes, and her teenage daughter screamed at her, "You can't get Nikes!" You know? So there are certain things that indeed have the image. And on the other side, you walk around with your, MacBook Pro, and you just feel so much more cool than if you have your Dell laptop. So definitely the image is important.
Why are so many companies specifically pushing their environmental record over other potential ethical factors, like how they treat their employees or other ways they serve the community? Why is a company going green so important from a marketing standpoint today?
You're right. The environment has clearly become the most important of the ethical issues in the public eye. I think there are several reasons. For one thing, this is something that has been talked about, for maybe 50 years, I'm thinking since Rachel Carson's book, certainly for many, many years. These are issues that are now taught in schools. Kids are taught about environmental problems. They're not taught about climate change, because that's still controversial, but just about things like pollution and general concern about the environment. And in many ways, it's bipartisan. It's non-controversial in many basic environmental issues. Recycling, every town has recycling drives. So this has just become part of our daily life now. And as I said, it tends to be bipartisan, nonpartisan, just less controversial, as well as it's something that has so many different branches. There are so many ways to be environmental. You can focus on using recycled ingredients. You can focus on being energy efficient. There are many, many ways to do this. Whereas issues, let's say, like treating the workers well, unionization is very controversial, and there are very few unions left. So that's not going to be a high priority. And if you're going to go overseas, it's easier to hide the way you're treating your workers. And besides which, that's being environmental can save money, right? If you use energy more efficiently, that saves money. Whereas treating your workers well costs money. If you're going to pay them more, that's going to cost more. So there are various business incentives to make the environment more important. So, and then animals is even lower priority, because most people will care more about people than they care about animals. So for various reasons, environment has definitely become the most important of the ethical issues.
You mentioned unions, and that was one of the things that really struck me about your book. You point out two sides of the ethical argument, that there are a couple of companies that you examined who are not union shops. And so there's the question of, is that in and of itself intrinsically a way to sort of knock them down a peg in terms of how you evaluate how they treat their workers? And yet, on the other hand, the same companies do seem to treat their workers very well. And you even reference somebody from one of the unions pointing out that they haven't even bothered trying to develop a union shop with this one company because the policies that are already in place are as good or better than anything that they could possibly negotiate.
Yeah, unionization is an interesting issue. The fact is less than 8% of the private sector workforce in this country is unionized. So the odds are that if I'm only going to have six companies, they're not going to be unionized. On top of which, though, you get the interesting situation with Starbucks, with Tom's of Maine in particular, where the founder, for a long time at any rate, was the CEO, and this person, both Howard Schultz at Starbucks and Tom Chappell at Tom's of Maine, have very clearly said, I'm such a nice guy. I do all these wonderful things for my workers. We don't need a union coming between me and my happy workers because I'm so nice. You don't need this union. And I'm very troubled by that because, you know, neither Tom Chappell or Howard Schultz is going to be around forever. In fact, Tom Chappell is gone from Tom's of Maine. Howard Schultz left Starbucks, came back, but he's not going to live forever. You can't rely on you know, the paternalistic goodwill of one guy, because the next person may not have that feeling, which is why you need the institutional protection of a union. But this, it gets to be the mindset of, in a way, the more ethical, the better a company it is, the less the company thinks it needs a union because it is treating its workers so well.
We have just a few minutes left. I want to try and get in at least one more call. We'll go next to Sylvia in Champaign. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi. Just on that last point, I just read recently that there are more, or I heard and read both, there are more co-ops, companies that are cooperatively owned by the workers than there are workers that are unionized in this country. But even there, the article I read said that even cooperatively owned companies have a union because when you're wearing your owner hat, it might be different than your worker hat. But when you spoke of treating the workers right, I thought of Credo, the telephone company, used to be Working Assets, and I wondered if you had investigated them at all.
Hi, Sylvia. That is such a fascinating point. Like, I hadn't heard that there are more people working for cooperatively owned companies than unionized companies. I'm not sure if that's good or not, in my view. I mean, I like the idea of the co-op companies, but I'd like to see more unionized companies. No, I didn't look into Working Assets. You know, I had obviously a limit to the number of companies I could do, and I was really focusing on your kind of, you know, not your investment company so much, but consumer companies that sold or made consumer goods. And well-known ones. That was the other thing. You know, I wanted big names that people have heard of that have the image so that I could then delve behind the image.
Mm-hmm. So you haven't looked into that at all, whether they're in your book or not, but you know about them.
Oh, definitely, the Working Assets, because I've written a lot about socially responsible investing, as Russ, the earlier caller, was talking about, and that's how that one began, as a way of socially responsible investing, of, you know, putting your money in the kind of companies that would do good.
We have just a minute or two left. I wanted to ask you, based on your investigation, would you conclude that the companies you examined generally do operate in an ethical, socially responsible way?
Of the six I examined, Timberland and Tom's of Maine, yes. American Apparel, in the end, I had to come down and say the sexual harassment is just so troubling that it is more important than the good it does. And, you know, I hated to do that, but I just, It's just so troubling. But the solution is very simple. You get rid of the CEO, who is really the source of all that. So I'd have to say no in that case. Now, Starbucks, yeah, but it's not as good as people think, but it still is more ethical than unethical. Apple, no, but it is getting better. And Trader Joe's is another borderline case. That is pretty darn close to 50-50.
What advice can you give to consumers who want to learn more about the companies that produce the products they buy and how they operate?
Sure. One thing, of course, since you're going to have that list on your website, so they can definitely, you know, go to that list and look at how many of these companies are rated by different organizations. This is a list that goes with the book Ethical Chic, and they'll find it on your website. In addition, I think that another good way is, you know, to, as I said, read some of the ingredients, to keep an eye out and, you know, look for examples that are in the news. If you have a chance, talk to the people who are working there. Not that you're going to directly ask them, do you like it here? But, you know, just kind of you get to know them, and you can sort of maybe watch them at work and see if people seem to be enjoying themselves or not. As well, there are things you can do as a consumer to try and be more ethical. Just a very simple thing, as I mentioned earlier, at Starbucks. If you're sitting and staying, ask for a mug. Ask for a reusable mug. Don't just take the paper cup. So there are many things that you can do as well to be a more ethical consumer.
Fran Hawthorne has been a writer or editor for a number of publications, including Fortune and Business Week, and is the author of five books, including her latest, Ethical Chic, The Inside Story of the Companies We Think We Love. Fran, thanks for talking with us today.
And thank you so much for inviting me.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program at will.illinois.edu/focus. Or to find today's program post, you can visit our homepage, again, will.illinois.edu. And you can find Focus under the program's drop-down menu. Just move your cursor over WILL-AM-FM and then click on Focus. Again, that's at will.illinois.edu.
Support for today's broadcast comes from ADM, now providing a new mobile site, FarmerView, for up-to-date futures, weather, market commentary, and local bids. Available at adm.com/farmerview.
On tomorrow's show, a conversation with Nina Jablonski, professor of anthropology at Penn State University and author of the book Living Color, The Biological and Social Meaning of Skin Color. The book investigates the social history of skin color from prehistory to the present, showing how our body's most visible trait influences our social interactions in profound and complex ways. We'll have that conversation with Nina Jablonski. That's on tomorrow's program. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Other members of our Focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Kyle Mabry's our technical director. I'm Craig Cohen. Thanks for joining us.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Auditory Care Center, an independent hearing care center serving Champaign, Piatt, Ford, Vermilion, and other East Central Illinois counties. Auditory Care Center offers hearing evaluations as well as selection, fitting, and repair of hearing aids at 892-5959 in Rantoul.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets where heading into the final hours of trading for this Thursday. Wheat futures are trading higher. They've been supported today by a lower-than-expected rating of the U.S. winter wheat crop from government analysts. USDA coming out with a rating today showing that the wheat history, 40% in good to excellent condition. That's down from 48% at the same time a year ago. And by the way, that 40% number in good to excellent is the worst single starting week ever for winter wheat conditions, as long as the USDA has been keeping track of the ratings. Also supportive is the outlook for Russia's 2012 wheat crop being trimmed today to 37.5 million metric tons, down from its prior forecast of 38 million. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat 913.5, up 9.5. May 935.5, up 9.75. December wheat in Chicago 875.25, up 10.75. May 895, up 8.75. December corn 760.5, up 4.75. July at 7.48¾, up 4¾. November soybeans, 15.68¼, up 21¼. July, 14.80¼, up 19½. November 13, 13.57, up 12½. December soybean meal, 4.88, up 5.80. December soybean oil, 50.69, up 53. December live cattle, 126.07½, up 15. You're listening to Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. It's 11 o'clock Central Time.